Hi, I'm Theo Finnegan from the English Department at Vancouver Island University. Welcome to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. We introduce you to the people and passions of the Faculty of Arts and Humanities at VIU and share stories about events and projects happening on campus. Craig Taylor is the author of the best-selling Londoners, as well as Return to Aikenfield and 1 Million Tiny Plays About Britain, which began as a column in the Guardian Weekend magazine. His most recent book, New Yorkers, A City and Its People in Our Time, was longlisted for the Brooklyn Public Library Prize. Craig's journalism has appeared in the New York Times, the Guardian, the Globe and Mail, Vancouver Sun, Granta, and McSweeney's, while his plays have been professionally performed throughout the UK and internationally. On Friday, February 11th from 10 till 11:30, Craig, along with Professor Sonnet LaBey, also from Creative Writing and Journalism, will give a presentation titled Listening to the World, Storying a Place. Hi, Craig. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So when did you first realize that writing creatively was something you wanted to do? Like, was this a childhood thing, dream from early on? Was it more recent? Like, what's the timeline there for creativity, if you can put a timeline on it?
I think it happened fairly early on, certainly in high school. And then I attended VIU back in the 90s when it was Malaspina University College, and it was a great place to immediately get involved in some of the same ways that students can get involved now. I started writing for the Navigator, became the entertainment editor. I was in the theater department, so there was an opportunity to write for the stage immediately. Mm. Just that combined with the extensive zine network that was out there in the right. 90s, both of those were very helpful. And one of the professors, a wonderful writer named Juji Gartner, was teaching here. And she wrote me a letter of reference for my first magazine job in Toronto. So VIU is like this crucial step.
Malaspina University College, right, was the name in the 90s and I think into the early 2000s. So, and now you're back on the faculty in creative writing and journalism. Does anything sort of jump out at you as like different? I mean, obviously the contexts are different and so on, but like what sort of immediately comes to mind if you sort of compare those two times and places?
Well, it seems like a bigger institution now, which is great. You know, I'm always happy that this place is growing and becoming a larger presence on the island and in the country. Mm. And then also with the students, it's just this idea of distribution. I mean, when I was going there, we were fighting for, you know, space at the photocopier to make these magazines ourselves, which then could be mailed out. And what I see now is just, you know, instant distribution for all these projects. So if you are making something, you know, really compelling on Vancouver Island, you can instantly distribute it all over the world. And that is just, you know, it continues to blow my mind. You know, I think we take it for granted now, but just this idea of sharing writing, of building a community is just something that wasn't there at the time. So in some ways that pilgrimage to major metropolitan centers is becoming less of an issue. And that's good news for people who are, you know, in places like Vancouver Island, where they can just create something wonderful and get it to Australia, to Europe, to the States.
It's, I grew up in Dunedin, New Zealand. So small, about the same size as Nanaimo, but, you know, way further away from sort of everything. But I totally get what you mean by back then. I mean, I was an undergrad in the 90s as well. And yeah, it felt like a long way away and like that you had to go somewhere else to sort of do anything, basically. And so that does seem to have, I think, changed. The internet obviously is the key driver there, right?
And just this idea of not having to wait for someone to sort of, you know, not waiting for the golden hand to come down and like tap you on the head and say, okay, now you're a writer.
You can anoint you.
Yeah, you can do this sort of thing from a lot of different locations.
Do you remember feeling like that was something that you did, that you almost did need approval from a bigger place, or like, was that something that was conscious to you back then? Or,
well, I think there were two engines of creativity happening for me, and one was this underground zine scene, which was fostered by Broken Pencil, this magazine, by different various zine fairs all over the place. And so in that way, there was this, you know, you were just producing things and making things. And then also, you know, I was lucky enough to then get involved in more traditional journalism, but I didn't go to journalism school. It was through, you know, these zines that I'd been photocopying and making myself that I was able to enter the mainstream journalism world. So I just think it's so important to have that sense of just being able to do it yourself.
Are zines still a kind of thing in the way they were? I presume the kind of spirit of it is alive and well in sort of more virtual ways, right? But
there will always be people who want to make something physical in the world. And so, you know, from what I see, self-publishing and that sort of thing has just exploded as well. Yeah. The means to create your own material, your own books, it's all there right now. I have friends in the UK working at Rough Trade Books, which is very much a, you know, an up from the ground zine operation, but just the level of what they can create is so extraordinary because of distribution, because of what we're able to do. But I think the spirit continues online. You know, people took the spirit of what was happening in the 90s and just changed it, adapted to each successive form, from blogs to, you know, whatever will come next. It's definitely there.
Sort of mind blowing, this explosion, right, of discourse and kind of circulation of stuff. And I'm just reading, we're actually listening to the audiobook of the third in the trilogy of the Wolf Hall trilogy by Hilary Mantel about Thomas Cromwell in the 16th century. And I keep thinking about that issue, actually, because they're always talking about having to send letters to someone in Venice, or, you know, finding a manuscript or getting a manuscript sent to them from somewhere. And it must have just taken so long to do things, which now we can do so quickly. I mean, I guess they had nothing else to compare it to. And it probably seemed like really quick and voluminous in comparison to parchment, let's say. But I think about that a lot, where what we take for granted has not always been, even in the last generation, has not always been the case, you know?
I think one of the nice things about what happened in the 90s is that it was so intentional. You had to build these magazines. You had to then write to people. You had to go and send them away. So there was this really intentional network. And so I think people a lot of readers and writers are returning to that. They're seeing that no matter how easily the communication can take shape, it still has to have this intentional element, and building community just has to be at the core of it.
You do quite a lot of different kinds of writing, right? Like your journalism, creative nonfiction. Would you say, is that a fair
label? Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Playwright. This is maybe a pretty big question, but like, is the process the same on some level for you? Or, you know, if you're writing a play, obviously you're thinking about some different things. Like, how is it different between, say, writing a book like your New York book versus doing a play?
I think it all stems from sort of an observational view of the world. A lot of my drama has come from writing, you know, things, writing down what I hear around me. The series that I did for the Guardian years ago was loosely based on overheard conversation. And so the idea was, you know, the world is sort of throwing up all of this conversation, and we can just tune into to tiny plays, to these little parts of it. So I think that's what sort of binds it together, that there's this sense of looking to the real world, looking to what's immediately out in front of me. And in that way, you know, it speaks to the power of reportage, even at a time when journalism is going through profound changes. So that even if you want to write, you know, plays or film scripts or creative nonfiction, whatever, you can still apply the lessons of reportage, of going out into the world, speaking to interesting people, respectfully dealing with that mm-hmm. material, transforming it into art. So I find that to be heartening in ways, because certainly my career has been over the span of a time when journalism has gone through, you know, profound changes. And so it's nice to know that what is at the ground level, that engagement with the world, can be used to produce different forms.
So in terms of reportage, do you think of yourself as having particular influences, like in terms of actual writers, or is it more kind of, I'm thinking of, like, I read recently John Steinbeck's book about going to Russia in the 1940s. And I'm just thinking about someone like that, for instance, or, you know, Joan Didion, or like, who do you sort of see as being your forebears, I guess?
I think I tend more towards like the people who are less aesthetically talented and more have to just like pound the pavement.
Pound the pavement. Yeah.
Like, I was reading Joan Didion's piece on El Salvador, because I was there recently, and I, you know, it's amazing, but she doesn't pound the pavement, and I just don't have the skill to get away with that. So, you know, I'm a big fan of Svetlana Alexeyevich, who produced incredible oral histories. I love the work of Studs Terkel. I love, mm-hmm. there's a long list of reporters. Yeah. Joseph Mitchell, you know, when I was doing my New York project, was always a guiding light. But it tends to be, you know, the people who just have to like endlessly hit the road and get in there. And, you know, my projects it's so many words. There are so many words involved, because I can't just, you know, dip in and create something beautiful.
I'm just listening. Another book I'm listening to. I'm doing listen to a lot of audiobooks recently, because I find I have a toddler, and so it doesn't always mean I have a lot of time to read. But there's a book by George Plimpton where he tries to play for the Detroit Lions as a non-athlete. So that's sort of, I guess that's one version of sort of participatory journalism, maybe, where he actually sort of becomes the subject in a way, rather than the people he's writing about, which maybe there are some issues with that, or problems with that, perhaps, like being too much a part of the story. Is that ever a challenge for you?
One of the great things about creating these books that are polyphonic in nature means that, especially at this point in time, it's I'm just very happy to be doing this kind of work where the authorial persona retreats back into the work, and the voices of the people are front and center. And so for me, artistically, that means that the books do not have the sameness of voice. There's a huge range of speech, subject matter, different types of people involved in the projects, so that it's not just this kind of writing style or this voice, which I just find more artistically challenging. I find it more satisfying. And these days, it seems to be a better way to work.
Hi there. This is Ben Henriquez from the Music Department at Vancouver Island University, and you are listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities on CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo.
Could you talk a little bit about something particularly about the London book and the New York book? Where did they come from, I suppose, is the question I want to ask here. Like, what's the origin of, you know, in a sense, grappling with a city?
For me, on a practical level, they were just these great excuses. I needed excuses to go into the city. And, you know, again, that's just naturally the kind of writing, the kind of journalism I was doing in England. I was... A lot of the British journalists would want to go to New York City or Los Angeles or somewhere else to do their reporting. And for me, England was very interesting. You know, it was foreign to me. And so, and the city of London was a place that, you know, I still love. And so this was a great excuse to go into the city. the New York book was different in many ways, but that form of investigating a city through the verbs, through the action words, through the you know, the words of the people who are working with it every day, it just seemed to be an exciting and translatable form, transferable form, I should say. And so, yeah, that was sort of the thinking behind them. They were both quite organic, you know. I loosely knew that it would involve other people's voices, but there was no master plan.
So you said you worked for The Guardian. Did that come out of that work, or were they separate?
It sort of stemmed from that work, because I was doing a lot of short columns where I'd have to find different people and speak to all sorts of different people. And so the book sort of grew out of that project. My first book was about a small English village. Mm. And so after that book, my editor and I decided, why don't we take on the city? You know, like, why not really dive into this place?
It's a fascinating idea, I think. Is it a lot of walking, like literally pounding the pavement, or is that more metaphorical? Or was it like you walked around and talked to people?
Yeah, there was a lot of walking, a lot of subway riding, just a lot of, you know. I have something called a chase book, which is just a series of notebooks where I just every day I would have to like reach out to 20 people and cold calls and phone calls and long letters of introduction. And, you know, it was just this sense of pushing at a city, and eventually a momentum took over and people would introduce me to others. But there was, a lot of travel, a lot of kind of sitting on trains, just waiting to get to a place. And a lot of being lost, you know, and sort of just embracing that as part of the experience, both geographically and artistically. And instead of saying that you are this male historian who's standing astride the city ready to, you know, pass along great knowledge, it was very much a sense of just being lost for years and hoping that the gathering would result in something.
I've been to New York once, and I mean, I'd love to go again, obviously, but the best day I had there, and I did a bunch of sort of quasi-touristy things too, but the best day I had was I was staying at a hotel around Madison Square, and I just walked down to Battery Park one day and did nothing other than just walk and look around and whatever. And so it wasn't really with a goal in mind. Although I suppose the sort of end of the island, you know, pulled me a little bit like Ishmael and at the start of Moby Dick, like there was a sense of like getting to the edge of things. But I remember just thinking, for such a big place, and you know, there was a sense of size and volume and so on, it felt very walkable and very intimate in a weird way. Did you sense something like that as well, like a sort of paradoxical sense of like, this is not just a megalopolis, it's like there's these little small moments you can find too. I don't know if that resonates with your experience.
Absolutely, especially Manhattan. Manhattan is so much a concentrate, and you will see things that you've read about or seen in films, you know, on one block, and then the next block you'll be confronted with something else completely memorable and mythologized, and you can do that, you know, the entire length of the island. There's just so much crushed into that place. And then, you know, when you go to other boroughs and you're farther out into the, you know, the hinterlands of the five boroughs, the experience of New York changes again. You know, it's so varied. You can be in parts of Queens where it feels like you're just, you know, in the countryside. You can be in the Rockaways, and I was just always shocked by just how much of the world was there in those five boroughs, both geographically and in a sense of the people too. You know, you would find the New Yorker that you've heard about and read about and seen in films, and then you would find people whose relationship with the city was so different, and that too, I think, made it a very rich experience. That range of experiences.
I remember being that feeling of both, like I've somehow been here before because I've seen it a million times in Law and Order or what, you know, film and so on, and then also being constantly surprised. Like, so one thing that I found, and it's just one person's experience of like 3 days being there, was like, it wasn't as rude as I thought it was going to be. Like, I went there expecting, you know, they had this cliche, I guess, of like abrasive New York, and there was some of that for sure, but it seemed I don't know, like I seem to run into a lot of nice people as well. You know, just
yeah, one of the themes for me was just this sort of this New York compassion, this metropolitan compassion that courses through the book. That's very well described by a guy named Ralph Martin, who became very dear to me, who's a doorkeeper at one of the soup kitchens, and speaks about a kind of compassion that can arise in a city like New York, because it's a place where you can easily gain access to the other, to people who are not like you, to you can be authentically in the lives of other people in a way that you might not be able to in a smaller community. And and for him, that is the purpose of New York City, is a like this staging ground for a kind of broadening compassion that you might not be able to do elsewhere. And so that spoke to my experience too, that of course there's kind of like this brusqueness and you get all of that, but deep in the workings of that city are people who are there for a reason. And sometimes the reason is beyond money or the other things that people come to New York for. It's this kind of compassion that they've chosen to seek out.
That makes a lot of sense to me based on that one experience that I had. I remember though, the probably the coolest moment of that trip and maybe my life actually was being asked directions. Like I was walking along and I had kind of no idea where I was, although it's sort of hard to get lost in a way just physically, because you can sort of, you know, there's a kind of a grid and so on. But I did get lost at another point, but yeah, someone asked me where's such and such, and I was like, I had to say I didn't know because I was from somewhere else. But I felt a weird sense of kind of like I'd made it somehow because someone thought I lived in New York. I don't know, it was a weird little moment.
Who gets to say that they're a New Yorker or a Londoner? And I think the term is flexible. And I always love to hear how, you know, some people wanted to lay claim to that phrase, and others were just too busy to think about it. And others, you know, couldn't imagine being anything but a New Yorker. And so, yeah, these words are so capacious, like they take in so many different types of people. But I think there are people who show up and it's like day three, they're dispensing directions and they are New Yorkers and they're choosing to say that. And, you know, more power to them.
Yeah. What's on your night table right now, reading wise?
Oh gosh, I've discovered audiobooks anew, like you. I think it's it's great to go walking with them. So yeah. I'm listening when I walk up to the university. I'm always listening to these massive, like Thomas Mann. I just did Buddenbrooks. I'm just doing Middlemarch right now. So they're good, like walking books, 30-hour walking books.
Yeah.
And then I'm reading Javier Marias is an old one by him. And yeah, I think that's, and then Leanne Simpson's book, most recent one. Always a lot on the go.
There's a lot going on. Yeah. I know that I actually looked at Middlemarch to get on my Libro account for audiobooks. And yeah, I think it was like 40 hours or something, which I love it, but I get through 5 minutes, fall asleep because I'm tired, not because it's boring. And then, so it's taking even longer than sort of 36 hours, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
We'll get there eventually. But Craig, thanks very much for joining me. And it was really a pleasure to talk to you. And I look forward to the colloquium presentation on Friday.
Great. Thanks, Theo.
You've been listening to Conversations in the Arts and Humanities. Thanks to Craig Taylor for joining me in conversation. Technical production by Robin Davies. Music by Greg Bush. The Colloquium series will be back on Friday, March 11th, with a presentation by Robin Davies from Media Studies titled Beyond Voices, Audio Media and the Sound of Scholarship. For more information, go to ah.viu.ca and click on Colloquium series. My name's Theo Finnegan. Thanks for listening.